Hello and welcome to the 20th episode of the Functional Nerds. We're the guys who like to sit around and talk about computers and technology, science fiction and fantasy stuff, and music, of course, in all its forms, because that's what John loves and that's what he does. And then we record that talk and share it with you, our faithful listeners. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger who publishes his stuff, but I do it online so far. No one's like come to me with the contract thing. So I'm a podcast dude and an all-around functional nerd, no matter what John Ottinger says. My partner in this is Mr. John Anilio Esquire. John, welcome back this week.
Oh, yeah. I'm bummed that I missed last week because you guys did talk so much about music with Modestet. I'm like, oh, I would have had so many great questions. I really, really should. So next time, we'll try to have him on again and we could talk. But anyway, I am John Anilio. I have a blog called scifisongs.blogspot.com. A lot of free music over there. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy things and nerdy things in general. And like I said, lots of that is free. And we do this podcast here every week called The Functional Nerds. And each week we have a third guest. And this week we are very honored to have a great best-selling author, author of The Warded Man and The Desert Spear, and that is Peter V. Brett.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, thanks for joining us, Peter. Peter, as I said, he's I just finished reading the Warded Man, which is his first novel, first published novel, at least anyway. And he has a new book out, which is the second part of a series called The Desert Spear, that is out in hardcover right now. And we have Peter on the show to talk about those books and lots of other topics. And I was fortunate enough to meet Peter about a month or so ago, I guess about 2 months ago now, at Balticon, where I met him at Merlafferty's I Should Be Writing live podcast. And Peter and I got to chatting and had lots of good stuff in common, and you know, I really was looking forward to getting him on the show. So, Peter, thanks for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad I finally made it out. It was funny at Balticon. I remember going to Merlafferty's podcast, and I was basically there because I was hanging out with Gail Carriger, who was on the show that night. And when you came out to start playing, I didn't know who you were at the time, and then you started playing George R. R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch, and I was like, oh, I know that song. I'd been like emailing the link to that song to all sorts of people like a month ago, so it was something like, oh, it's that guy. And then as soon as that happened, I was like, I made a point of getting to talk to you after the show. So I'm really glad I did, and I'm glad I had a chance to come out on the podcast with you guys.
Oh, well, thanks. That's really kind of you to say. And that was a good time, and we'll have to try to get Gail on the show too, because Gail is a very colorful character in the science fiction fantasy publishing field, and she's got a lot of good things to say too. But you know, I guess we can get started. There's a lot of different things we could talk about, but you know, I like whenever we have anybody on, I kind of like talking about how they're where they are now. Like, what's their journey from, you know, the time, you know, that they sort of got started in all their creative endeavors to where they are now. And in your case, as a successful author, I know in your bio, it says that you went to the University of Buffalo and that you have a Bachelor of Arts in English Literature and Art History. But then you were spent a decade in pharmaceutical publishing before returning to writing. Now that's obviously a very condensed version. of your
that's how much time you got.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess give us
we like the Twitter bio.
Yeah,
140 characters or less. That's all people can grasp anymore.
Yeah. But you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, what got you in? You know, obviously you write fantasy. What are some of the things that maybe as a kid that you were into that sort of helped build the base of, you know, what you write about now? And then, you know, sort of the steps from becoming someone who is maybe a, you know, obviously you had a day job like so many authors do for a long time. Yeah. And now you're a full-time author. What's sort of the steps of going from your day job to making that transition? So I know that's a lot, but you know.
I'll try and run through it fairly quick. Mm-hmm. So I think when I was a kid, the first book, the real book without pictures in it that I ever read, like of my own free will, was The Hobbit. And I think that that kind of set the tone for the rest of my life in a lot of ways. You know, I kind of tended to idolize my older brother and do whatever he wanted to do. And so he had a copy of The Hobbit that I took from him, stole it out of his room and read it and loved it. And he used to play Dungeons and Dragons with his friends, and they would never let me play because I was a little kid brother that nobody wanted to play with. So I would like borrow his books and like play with my little sister, who was like 4 years younger than me. And so we kind of didn't even know what we were doing. I liked the pictures in the books, and I liked to pretend that I knew what I was doing. But that was like first edition D&D, which was really hard to grasp, even if you're in college, much less seven.
All you had to do at that point was just roll the dice and pretend you knew what it meant.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they had these big, like matrix charts to try and figure out how everything worked. After that, I kind of got into comic books for a really long time. Didn't read novels pretty much at all. I wanted to be a comic book artist for a while. And then when I realized that I sucked as an artist, I wanted to be a comic book writer. My father got kind of frustrated that all I was reading was comics and not real books, because my parents are big readers. So he went to the, he remembered that I liked The Hobbit. He went to the library and just went to the fantasy section and pretty much picked a book at random and brought it home and said, here's a book for you. And that book was the Wish Song of Shannara by Terry Brooks. And so I read
Not a bad one. Not a bad one.
No, not at all. And I read that, and then I read every book by Terry Brooks, and then like started going to the fantasy section of the library myself, and then started buying like all the Forgotten Realms books, and I've read hundreds and hundreds of fantasy novels since then. I started writing for real in high school. I wrote my first novel in high school when I was 17. It was a terrible, terrible book that will never see the light of day. but I learned a lot. I learned a lot writing it. And so,
have you ever? I'm sorry. Have you ever heard the live Greg Allman song where he says something along? He's like, "I'm going to play it, the first song I ever wrote," and everybody kind of cheers. And he says, "Well, actually, I'm sorry. First song I ever wrote and kept."
Well, that's about sums it up. I mean, I wrote four novels before I even reached a point where I was willing to show it to anyone professional.
Sure.
I learned a lot with each one. And even if I look back at some of those older ones, there's a lot of stuff that I'm proud of in it, but there's also a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, I really didn't know what I was doing here, and I needed the practice and I needed to work it out. So, when I was on my fourth book, I met Joshua Bilmes at Science Fiction Writers of America party. Joshua is a big literary agent. He's agent to Brandon Sanderson and to Charlene Harris and Tanya Huff and John Hemry, like a lot of really big authors. And I said to him, I was like, I'm a writer and I've written a few books, but I'm not really ready to show them to anyone because I don't think they're good enough. And he gave me a scolding. Saying, don't you refuse books for me. I refuse books. So you send me your books and I will decide whether or not they should be, whether they're good enough or not. So when a big agent tells you to send him something, you send him something. So immediately I went out and sent him a book that I was working on called The Painted Man, which he rejected. And then I sent him another book that I'd written called Snowcrest, which he also rejected. But he afterwards called me up and he's like, I'd like to take you out for coffee. And we went out and he said, it's obvious that you have a lot of talent, but it's also clear that you taught yourself how to write and you're making some basic kind of amateur mistakes. And so he gave me a book on writing called Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith. And he said, read this book, go back to The Painted Man and fix it. And so I took a year to do that. And at the time, I was working in pharmaceutical publishing as an editor and as a production manager. And so I was getting a lot of good practical skills at editing and working with writers and working with printing presses and things like that. But I was doing something that I didn't have any interest in. What I really wanted to be doing was writing fantasy. And so I had very little free time to write. So I bought a Windows mobile phone with a full keyboard that would sync to Microsoft Word so that I could put Microsoft Word files on it and write anywhere. And so what I would do for that rewrite, where I essentially threw out 60% of the original manuscript of The Painted Man and rewrote all of that from scratch, I would get on the subway every morning. I had about an hour's commute to and from work, so an hour each way on the subway. And I would get on the subway, and I would, you know, shove an old lady out of the way and grab a seat and just sit there and, like, thumb write on my phone for the whole trip. And I found that I got faster and faster at that, to the point where I was writing about 350, 400 words per trip, so about 800 words a day just from that. And then I would go home and sync it back to my desktop and clean it up. And I set myself at 1,000 words a day. So I would add another 200 words or so
I'm thinking, you know, writing a book on your phone is pretty hardcore badass.
It's fun. In a lot of circles, I'm more famous for that than for writing a bestseller. Like the fact that the book was written on a phone netted me a lot of, you know, I was on Boing Boing and Wired and,
oh, yeah,
and Boy Genius Report, and everybody was all like excited about that. Like, nobody cared about the book. Like, it didn't affect my sales at all. But, like, it was, you know, and like I saw, like, the article translated into all different languages. Like, it was a weird little 15 minutes of fame about writing on the phone. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was trying to do it to be hardcore or trying to do it to do something that no one had ever done before. I just didn't have time to write. I had a job where I was working until, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. I had 2 hours of commute time. I had a new wife. I had just gotten married. We had just bought our house, and I had a life. And so
it's rough.
Writing was really important to me, and I had to make time, and that was the only time that I had. And I was like, how can I find a way to make this annoying commute productive? And so that's kind of what forced me into writing on the mobile phone.
Well, just so you know, I mean, they do now have, like, Dragon naturally speaking for your phone.
Yeah, because you want to just sit on the subway and talking to yourself. You know, it's talking about fighting monsters. And,
hey,
like, why not? Half of the other people on the subway are already doing that. So it's
and pretty much everybody will leave you alone. They'll be like, man, get away from that guy.
In New York, we now have the saying, if you see something, say something. And I think that if someone sees, like, a crazy person muttering to himself about magic in the corner, they're probably going to have the police come and pull me off the train.
Yeah, I had a friend that used to commute into the city. He was a drummer. He was in a band that I was in, and he, if he ever felt a little nervous on the subway, he'd put his headphones on, and he liked Queensryche, that band Queensryche, a lot, and sure. he would like air drum all the drum parts just so people would stop bothering him a lot of times on the subway. But
the guy in Queensryche had the best drum set ever.
Oh yes,
it was made out of like chains that were like welded together, so they were like a solid structure. That was an awesome drum kit.
Yeah, Scott Rockenfield, I believe is his name. A little claim to fame. I could probably name just about every band member of any sort of 80s metal, progressive rock, hair metal band. I have a staggeringly large amount of useless knowledge about the lineups of those bands. So
what was the name of the all lady heavy metal band?
Vixen.
Or the Pandoras, depending.
Yeah.
No, Vixen was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, that was the big. That was the more popular one.
I think.
So, if I wanted to know, like, the lead singer of the Bullet Boys, you could pull that out.
You know, that one I don't know. I
have you're probably that. Better off.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I had
a big hair metal phase. I had crazy long hair. My hair was like down in the middle of my back, and like I looked like Ian Astbury from The Cult for a while.
Not a bad look.
Yeah, it was before my hair. Thinned enough where I was like, you know what, maybe it's time to cut that short.
Have you seen that movie, The Rocker?
No,
I know it's Rainn Wilson's in that.
Yeah,
Patrick, is that the one? Yeah, yeah. I keep meaning to watch that, and I haven't seen it yet.
It's pretty funny. You know, it's about the heavy metal guy. He's the drummer. He kind of starts the band. He names the band. They're on the brink of getting huge. And of course the sleazy manager comes in to the other three guys and says, you know, you guys are great, but you got to dump the drummer. And then it's like 20 years later in his life. But there's a great part where his nephew has a band and they need a new drummer, and he's in the house and he hears a drum machine. And he walks out to the garage, and this kid is there with this little drum machine, you know, like doing mixes of drums and stuff. And he's like, "Get out! You are a disgrace! Get out!" And he just starts, I mean, I almost expect the kid to start crying just because he's like, "Real men drum!"
But anyway, so let's get back to what you're talking about with like the, so your phone, I can relate to the productivity thing. I think a lot of times people, I don't want to say they make excuses for not getting work done, but it's very easy to not get things done. And if you want to do something badly enough, you can find the time. And it doesn't surprise me that you got written up on Boing Boing and all those other things, because it's commendable that you were able to find that time, but you know, you were going to do it one way or the other. And that was the best solution for that. So it's funny. Is that what eventually became The Warded Man? Is that what you were working on?
Yeah. That book was the book that kind of did it. I spent a year working on that. I must've written probably 100,000 words just on the subway. Mm-hmm. You know, and also, you know, it wasn't only on the subway. I was also like, I made a point to sometimes tell my friends, like, you know what, I can't go out drinking tonight. I can't go out and do this. I can't do that. I got to go home and write. Because like you say, if something's important to you, you make time to do it, because it's more than something you want to do. It's something that you kind of need to do. Mm-hmm. And so, I had a long talk with my wife where I'm like, look, it doesn't mean I don't love you, but I'm going to have to spend a couple hours a night writing, and like, you're going to need to fill that time some other way. I can't just watch TV with you, because I should be writing, as the saying goes.
I got an email like yesterday from JP over at SF Signal. Mm-hmm. And he says, Patrick, you're a really busy guy. How do you manage it? And so I start telling him like all this stuff, like, well, you know, I take my lunch hours and I take my laptop and I work on this, and then I get home and, you know, and at 10 o'clock, that's when I'd work on this, you know, and I just really do blah, 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 blah. I said, and of course, and I don't have a girlfriend right now. And he's like, oh, well, that's the answer. You just don't have a girlfriend. You don't have any kids. That's why you have time to mess around with all this stuff.
Well, the kids do eat into it. I'll tell you that. Yeah.
Kids. Anyway.
So after about a year, I had a new manuscript and I took it back to Joshua, and I was expecting him to reject it again, because I'd gotten used to that. What I didn't expect was for him to call me up and say, hey, I think this is the best book I've read this year and I'm eager to represent it.
Awesome.
Which was like that was like the life changing phone call where I was kind of just like, can you say that again slowly?
Can you say that into the recorder?
Let me take off my pants while you say that. he took the book to market not that long after that, and it sold I got a few rejections, and then the book sold to Delray Books, and then right after that Harper Voyager in the UK picked it up, and after that it kind of I have a really good agent who has a lot of contacts in other countries, and it was like a domino effect once the big two had picked it up, that now it's published in I think 19 languages and has done really well. It's been an amazing transition to go from kind of a cubicle job that I hated to doing kind of what I always dreamed about doing but never thought I would ever actually get to do. Mm-hmm. Because I never thought that I would actually be a professional writer. Like, I always wanted to do it, and I was always practicing and trying to get there, but I never really expected it to happen. And so it came as a big shock when it actually did. And even now, it's kind of surreal.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. Now, I have a couple of things that I wanted to ask you because I just finished the book just a few days ago. And the book that now I'm a notoriously slow reader, so it takes me a while to get through things. But the book that I read right before yours was Shadow March by Tad Williams, and mm-hmm. Tad Williams is. His books are quite long, and I'm a big Tad Williams fan, and I liked Shadow March quite a bit. But what I really liked about your book compared to Tad Williams and compared to a lot of the recent books that I've read is how it's just game on right from the beginning. There's, you know, it doesn't take, you know, there, I think, you know, there's action right at the start, and I really like, now I'm not a writer. Obviously, I'm a songwriter, but I've done writing for fun, like I did NaNoWriMo a couple times, and I've read. Sure. I went through a period where I thought I was going to be sort of like a punk rock writer. I read that NaNoWriMo book where they were like, "Hey, there's guys that sell records that can barely play. Why not be a writer that could barely write?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll do that." So that was something I dabbled in for a little while, but it's not something that I do anymore. But I read a lot of like how to write books, and you know, I know a lot of sort of the wisdom is to, you know, show don't tell, and just like kind of get on with it. And I really love that about your book, how you make this rich world, but there's never like long exposition or anything like that. It's action, it's character, and it's great. One of the things that, the other thing that I liked about it was how, you know, there is a clearly defined evil in the book. And I wonder, you know, where did that sort of idea come from? Of, you know, is that just sort of your background in playing Dungeons and Dragons and comics, of, you know, wanting to have like a very clear, I mean, you know, it wasn't like Shades of Grey. We talked to Lou Anders and he has the Sword and Sorcery books, and how in Sword and Sorcery it's more of gray areas of like, we don't know who's good, we don't know who's bad in the war.
Morally ambiguous.
Yeah, morally
ambiguous, I think.
I mean, I don't know. I would say that I probably don't have the black and white good and evil, and that I do focus more on the shades of gray, because and I'll say that by saying that the demons in the book who I assume are what you're referring to as evil are kind
spoiler.
Of
yeah well, the, I mean, they're on like the first page.
It's hardly a spoiler to say that. The concept behind the book is that when the sun sets, these demons come out, they rise up out of the ground, and they essentially just ravage the land and slaughter everything. But they do it in kind – I mean, they're
teenagers. They're teenagers.
In a manner of speaking. And so the only way to protect you – like they're magical, so they're immortal, and they're essentially indestructible, and – there's really no way to fight them without magic of your own. And so people have taken to drawing these magical symbols around their homes to protect themselves. And they kind of hide at night and just wait for the sun to come up so they can go back outside. And but the demons are less evil and more just like kind of vicious killing machines, mm-hmm. at least in the first book. Yeah. And so I think the Shades of Grey is more like what's happening to the humans while they're just clustered together, hiding in terror all mm-hmm. night, every night. And what does that do to people, and how does that affect them? And where you see kind of the good and dark sides of individual people, where you see someone who is generally someone that you would consider an evil, horrible person, but then they'll go and risk their life to save somebody from a demon. And then someone else who seems like a really, really good person. And then, you know, when there's demon coming for their family, they go and save themselves. And it's those kinds of questions about good and evil and moral ambiguity that I really wanted to address in the story and write a story about fear. I think the driving theme of the Warded Man is fear and how it affects people, and it makes some people freeze up and not be able to do anything, and it makes other people leap into action and maybe not even do something that's wise, but they just can't sit still and they have to do something. Mm-hmm. And it was those kinds of things that I really wanted to address. And I think that that's something, particularly as someone who spent 9/11 in the city of Manhattan, I think that's something that really kind of resonates with people. And it was something that I wanted to kind of write about. So I do think that there's a lot of moral ambiguity in there.
Oh,
it's
sure.
Just not but you can still like just kill demons without feeling remorse and regret that you're slaughtering.
Mm-hmm. Now with the wards, I thought that was a really interesting concept. Now are you kind of taking inspiration for the wards from other cultures or was that something that you kind of just came up with on your own, or sort of symbols warding against evil? Is there any particular folklore or culture that you're drawing on for that?
It was more of a general thing. I mean, I think that symbol magic and the idea that symbols can protect you from evil is something that's cross-cultural. I think
sure.
that almost every culture has that. And it was those types of things that I wanted to kind of hit on in the book, where it's like fear of nightfall, fear of demons, fear, like using magic symbols to protect yourself are all themes that almost every culture has their own set of stories based on that sort of thing. And so I felt like that would be something that could really resonate with a wide audience because of that. And I think that's why I think that kind of contributes to why I think a lot of people have enjoyed the books.
What's kind of good about that, and when you're talking about different cultures, is a lot of people today have these superstitions that they don't even know really where they came from. They just know that that's what they do because that's what their mom
yeah.
did and that's what their grandma did. So when you're writing about that kind of stuff, I think you're kind of touching almost, touching a nerve that they don't even realize is there.
It's yeah, just, I think there's kind of like a what do you call it? Like a racial knowledge, I think, about these things.
Where genetic memory, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's been like encoded into us to be afraid of the dark because you can't see it at night, and to think that there's stuff lurking out there in the darkness that could jump on you, the monster under the bed or whatever. And that, I think that when you touch on those sorts of themes and stories, like that's what really makes it work for people. And so I
sure.
try to do that on a regular basis to hit on those things and make people kind of feel like they can relate to what's going on with the characters, even though they're in a fantasy world.
Sure. Mm.
And one of the other things that that I really liked about the book was just sort of the clarity of the storytelling. A lot of times when you're dealing with fantasy or epic fantasy, and it's my preferred genre. A lot of times when you have so many characters and so many different things going on, you'll get to the end of the book and a lot of times there'll be a feeling of, yeah, but what happened to these guys? And what happened
yeah.
to this? And a lot of like just – and if you're writing an ongoing series, it can always be like, oh, well –
it gets harder with each book, I'll tell you.
I imagine. But there's sort of there's the one, Arlen, who's the main character in the book, and then – Alicia, and now do you pronounce it Roger or
Roger?
Roger, okay, because I was kind of going back and forth between Roger and Roger. Okay,
yeah,
Roger.
Yeah.
Okay, and so they're sort of the main, or I would define them as the main characters, and I just felt like it was so clear, and it was so it felt good reading it. Like it felt like yes, this is what's happening. This is what I want to happen, or not, I shouldn't say it. We had Mike Resnick on the podcast 2 weeks ago, and I wrote a song for his book that's published in the appendix of his last book. And when we were talking about that, I was saying like, oh, but don't listen to the last couple of verses because I kind of give away the ending of the series. And then Resnick went off on this. He's like, you know what? I have people, reviewers that will say like, oh, I guessed the ending 100 pages in. And he's like, He's like, you're supposed to. You know, yeah. His whole thing was that if you're writing a mystery, then yeah. But he's like, if you're writing like a fantasy or something, he sort of likened it to mythology. And he's like, you're kind of supposed to know where it's going. And he didn't look at that as a bad thing or a limit of the writing. It's that we sort of, you were just talking before about the wards and about how it's sort of this genetic encoding. I think mythology is the same way, where it's like, you know, the whole hero's journey thing or all these different, you know, aspects or characteristics of mythology that just feel good. And I'm not really talking about the mythology part of it, but just as you were building the world and building these characters, I found, you know, the ending of the book just to be very satisfactory. It was like, yeah. And I don't, yeah. As much as I love fantasy and science fiction, I'm often not satisfied at the end. Like I enjoyed the journey, but I wasn't satisfied at the end. And I was very satisfied by the end of the book. It had a nice closure, but then obviously moving on into the other book. So I thought that was really great. And I've been recommending this book to everybody because I really thought
that's fantastic.
It's great. And to know that you're, you know, hacking away at this on your mobile phone on the subway makes it all the more impressive, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously another question that I wanted to ask you is about Roger, who you know, he is a musician, and so obviously that's appealing to me. So I wanted to ask you where your do you have any sort of background or experience in music where you wanted to have sort of work music into the book or have a musical character, or was just something that you thought would add something to the story?
I have failed to learn how to play just about every instrument there is. I love music so much, and I've just come to embrace the fact that I'm not good at making it, whether it's because I wasn't willing to put in the hours necessary to do it in the way that I was for writing or whatever that could be, or it could just be that like there was a natural inclination to it that I didn't have. But I really do love music. I listen to music while I'm writing all the time. I pretty much listen to music constantly. I have it on in my house at all times, and I have different music that I'll listen to depending on what I'm doing, or even the type of scene that I'm writing. You know, if I'm writing an action scene, I'll probably choose a different sort of music than I would if I'm writing something else.
That's interesting because I've heard other authors say similar things. You know, that they have different styles, different bands that they listen to depending on what it is they're writing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if I'm writing action, it's like Tool and Metallica and like Clutch, and you know, like really kind of testosterone-y music. And you know, but if I'm writing like a love scene or writing something a little calmer, you know, I'll listen to something like
Poison or Queensryche.
I'll switch, you know, greatly, and I'll be listening to Iron and Wine or Lorena McKennitt sometimes I'll listen to classical music or instrumentals. I have a pretty broad musical taste. I have a huge, you know, 20,000 song collection on iTunes and a lot of different playlists. I've been using Genius to make playlists a lot lately and kind of forcing myself to listen to different things and see what I like and what I don't like and use that to make new playlists. And so I'm always doing that. And so with Roger, I played the violin briefly when I was a kid and I always really loved the instrument and I feel like it's kind of an underused instrument in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to include that. And it's nice to have, you know, your bard character, as it were, you know, like the character who's like a storyteller and can sometimes provide amusing exposition for things you know, it's a handy thing to have in a story. And so when I was creating the character, I was kind of basing it on those aspects. But it wasn't until I essentially wrote out his life story. The book starts when Roger's three, and it was his actual story that I think made the character into who he is, and really kind of made him resonate. And I think that in some ways his is the most tragic story. Well, each one of the characters has their own tragedies, but he has a particularly hard life. And I think that kind of makes the musical aspect of his character resonate more, because you know that there's a lot of emotion and feeling when he starts playing something. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. I liked that aspect of it, but there are a lot of times when I would sit back and be like, okay, I need to do some research before I can write this next scene, because I have to write about music and I don't really know, you know, I can't read sheet music. I don't know a lot about it, and I don't want to get it wrong and have somebody who does know music get thrown out of the book, you know?
Oh, that never happens.
Didn't happen to you while you're reading this book.
No. Well, if you ever have any musical scenes, if you want to run them by me, I can make sure that you got it all. If you don't want to feel like doing an internet search, I'd be glad to be a beta reader of your music sections. If you want to, you know, make sure that you don't, piss off any of the musicians, you know, because they're not typically an obnoxious bunch that's going to call you on it. So, oh, wait a minute. They totally are.
They won't be forgiving.
Yeah.
In books, you can't really mess up music and you can't screw up horses. If you say the wrong thing about horses, like, there's so many fantasy fans that love horses, they will jump down your throat. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, in general, like, everybody's an expert at something. Mm-hmm. And the last thing a writer wants to do is bullshit something that they don't know and then have somebody who does know about it get thrown out of the book.
Yeah.
You know? And so... I try to do as much research as I can to avoid things like that.
I was just listening to Scott Sigler, if you know who he is. He is an author, and he writes, I guess, sort of these horror, sort of science kind of novels. And he was just on the Nerdist podcast, which is Chris Hardwick. And he was talking about how, now obviously, maybe not so obviously, but Scott Sigler sort of got published in a roundabout way because he podcast his novels first, built up a very big audience podcasting his novels, and then got book deals that way. But because of that, so I think his latest book is Ancestor, and he's selling quite well, I believe, now. But he was saying, sort of by building this community through doing a podcast, by podcasting his novel, and because he did a lot of, there's a lot of hard science in his books, he actually now at this point has four or five scientists that he'll send his novel to as he's working on it to check over the science, just to make sure he has it right. Because, you know, and he goes, it was just like one of his listeners early on was like, really love that you're working all the science in, but you got this wrong and this wrong and this wrong. In the future, do you want me to help? So, you know, I find that kind of an interesting, you know, world that we live in, that an author or any kind of creative person can have that sort of contact with their audience in that way, where, you know, because I think, you know, 10 years ago, that kind of concept would be almost insane. And now I think it's almost common, you know.
And now I can, like, Twitter a question and have, you know, like dozens of people respond to it. Or I can just go, I mean, Wikipedia, I use it all the time to research like little minutiae, you know, like if there's something big and important that you really want to research, obviously you do it, you look into it a little more deeply. But if you just want to, like, you know, say, like, okay, I need to write 2 seconds in a brewery, let me just get a quick idea of how beer is made so I can write this and not sound like I don't know what I'm talking about. Wikipedia is perfect for stuff like that. And so I don't know what writers did before they had access.
Well, Wikipedia is kind of interesting too, because, you know, I think my own sort of bias against Wikipedia was that, like, oh, anybody can write on it, it's not accurate. And then I forget what books that I read. I don't remember which one. Maybe it was The Long Tail or one of those Chris Anderson books. And, you know, the research shows that Wikipedia on any given day is as accurate or more accurate than, like, Britannica is.
Yeah.
It's you know, I mean, obviously someone can go in there and just write a bunch of BS, but it'll be taken down.
The thing is, there's a lot of people fact-checking it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
More people than you'd think.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of us feel like, well, I'm too lazy to waste my time spending, you know, fact-checking Wikipedia, so no one must do that. But the fact is that there's a lot of people who get a lot of enjoyment out of doing stuff like that.
Sure.
Well, and Twitter is huge too, just like you said. Yeah. Bill Prady, or Prady, I'm not sure how his name is pronounced. He's a writer, ex-producer, whatever, of The Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a couple days ago, he had a question up about Doctor Who. And I answered it, and I'm sure a bunch of other, you know, billion other people answered it. But it's kind of cool because you're thinking in the back of your head, I just answered a question for him that might end up in that show.
Yeah, I see writers doing it all the time now. And every once in a while, I'll have a little random question about something or other, and I'll throw up on Twitter and I'll get responses right away that can kind of like make me feel a little more confident in something that I'm writing. And so it's a handy resource that goes both ways. And it's nice to have a reason to interact with the people that are following you too. A lot of times you post things and you're kind of just posting in the dark, you know, you don't get responses to everything. So it's nice to know that people are listening every once in a while.
Sure. Well, why don't we maybe you could tell us a little bit about, now obviously the second book is already out, so we talked a good bit about the first book. I don't know if you want to maybe give a little bit of a plug for the second book that's now out in hardcover and what people can sort of look forward to in that volume.
The second book, The Desert Spear, is kind of the other guy's side of the story. It focuses on a character named Jardir who encounters Arlen in the first book, and they have a conflict. And you pretty much take Arlen's side in the first book. And Jardir very much comes off as a villain. And in the second book, I start out in very much a similar way as the first one, where Jardir is a child, the same way that Arlen starts off as a child in The Warded Man. The Desert Spear opens up with Jardir, 9 years old, drafted into the army, and shows his kind of path of growing up and introduces him as a person. And you get to see the pivotal moments in his life and how it gets him to that same point where he has this conflict with Arlen. And you get a very different perspective on it and a very different perspective on his culture and his belief system. And I think that it adds a big layer of depth to the series as a whole, and makes you really kind of question who the ultimate hero of the series might be.
Now, when you say that you kind of show a different perspective, is it are you seeing like scenes from the first book that they were in together? Do you see that in the second book, but from the other guy's point of view?
There's a couple of scenes like that. I didn't want to retell the whole book from another person's point of view because that can get tiresome. Although there are authors who do it well. For the most part, it's interesting. Like Arlen appears in a number of scenes in The Desert Spear that are totally new, where you see kind of a young Arlen, out in the desert, like, you know, learning the language in this new culture and trying to integrate himself into it and getting into all sorts of crazy action and showing how he and Jardir were actually best friends, like literally and really. And so those are some of my favorite scenes in the book where it's like the two of them running around like Riggs and Murtaugh. But then I do show the conflict between the two of them from Jardir's perspective directly, because I thought that was a pivotal scene that really needed to kind of have both sides of the story told.
Sure.
And you may walk away from it still with the same opinion you had after the first book, or you may walk away from it thinking it a little bit differently. People have had widely varied reactions to it, and I think that that's what I wanted. You know, I wanted people to have to kind of think about it and not really know for sure who's right and who's wrong, because they're both kind of right and they're both kind of wrong.
Sure. And the reason I asked the question was because last week when I was chatting with Ellie Modisette Jr., I brought up the fact that he wrote two books separated by a lot of different books. So like, you know, here's this book and then several other books. And then he kind of came back to the same story, but told it from the perspective of the other side. And you actually saw, it was essentially like a little war going on. And in the first book, you had these two brothers, and they were the heroes, and you were rooting for them, and you saw how they were dealing with the, you know, the evil white wizards and what they were going through. And then four or five books later, you come back, and now you're seeing it from the perspective of the white wizards. And, you know, as far as they're concerned, they're the good guys. And they're fighting.
Well, everybody thinks that they're the good guys.
Sure.
And I think that in a lot of times, in, particularly in fantasy, there's this temptation to have one person who's like over the top evil and one person who's the hero, and like reality just doesn't work that way, and it's kind of disingenuous in some ways. And so you want, when you're writing a villain, if you're writing a good villain, or I mean, you shouldn't even think of them as a villain. You should get in their shoes and kind of see what their goals are and what they're looking to do. And one of the things that I really wanted to do was to take Jardier, and as I call it, pull a Jamie Lannister with him, and have it be like that in the Desert Spear, when Jardier encounters a problem, I wanted the reader to be rooting for him to solve it and succeed. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I kind of felt like if I could do that, I could do anything.
I'm confused by this name Lannister. I don't understand what that's all about. John, do you have any idea what he's talking about?
Yeah, I do, in fact. Yeah, but you know, it's funny that you mentioned that with the villains, because you know, I never knew how important having either a sympathetic villain or just a well developed, more of just developing the intentions behind your villain, because I that never really was brought home to me until I remember going to see Independence Day, the Will Smith movie, when it came out. And I remember I was in college at the time, and my friend and I, who were like big Star Wars fans, were like, this is going to be great. And like, we went there, and you know, I guess it was, you know, somewhere around 45 minutes into the movie, I started realizing like, I don't think this movie's very good. Mm-hmm. And then they sort of encounter the alien on the ship, and it's just, there's nothing there. There's like no encounter. It's just like, we want to kill you. And then that was it. And I'm like, wow, they made
this stuff.
Yeah. They made this whole movie with that villain. That's insanity. And say what you want about, you know, Star Wars. Star Wars has a sympathetic villain. You know, Vader is a sympathetic villain, you know? So, I mean, I think that's why something like that resonates.
You know, Empire provided safe trade routes and police forces.
Yeah.
And an organization, and I bet they have really good public schools.
Yep. and Independence Day had Brent Spiner in it.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. And you know, the other sympathetic villain I'm thinking of is Magneto. You know, I mean, Magneto is a great villain because is he a villain? I mean, yeah, I guess he does some bad things, but it's, you know, it's someone that you can relate to, that you understand what they're doing. And I think that should always be the case when you're coming up with your characters. There should always be, you should always, you know, relate to them on one way or the other. So
I completely agree.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading the second one now, because
you're both full of crap.
I think villains should be cardboard. That's what I think. But that's great. Now, the other thing I wanted to, how many books this series is going to be? I mean, is that
five?
Sort of, five. Awesome.
Five. I've been writing the occasional novella set in the same world. Mm-hmm. They've been coming out from Subterranean Press. I have one out called The Great Bazaar, and another one coming out later this year called Brian's Gold, which have characters from the series, and they're set in the same world. And I think that they add something to the overall story, but they're kind of standalone things, and you don't really need them to enjoy the series as a whole. But I don't want to be writing these books for the rest of my life. I want to have this be a project that has a beginning, middle, and an end, and then I can finish it and then go on and do something different.
That sounds a little bit familiar. I'm trying to think of who said that. I think it was Robert Jordan. It's only going to be five books, but now it's only going to be seven.
It's very easy to keep expanding, especially when your books are successful. Admittedly, I started to lose patience in some of the later Wheel of Time books. I held on, and I think that Brandon Sanderson is doing a really good job in wrapping it up. But it got a little frustrating when, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I read Crossroads to Twilight, and nothing happened.
Yeah, that was
you know, the
book.
Entire book, nothing happened.
That's a terrible
and,
book.
or stuff happened, but it had nothing to do with anything and like left me feeling totally unsatisfied. And so I don't want to start writing books like that. And so I have the third book, which I'm working on now, which is plotted out in enormous detail. Like my plot is 250 pages long. And so I know everything that happens in that book. And then I have the fourth book, which I have a kind of a loose plot for, and then the fifth book, which ties up the series. And it's possible that one of those books will be 1,000 pages long, but I really want to get it done in 5 books and go and do something different so that I can kind of leave it as my legacy rather than have it be something open-ended that maybe I'll never finish or whatever. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that to my fans. I don't want to do that to myself. And I know how the series ends, so there's no reason for me to dilly-dally too much. But I will say that when you spend a lot of time creating a fantasy setting and it's solid, like there's an endless number of stories that you can tell within that setting. And so there is a great temptation to just keep on doing it.
Sure.
And so I'm not saying that I probably won't, once the series is over, I probably won't revisit the same characters again, but I might go back to that same world and write some other stories with different characters. I don't know.
And that's kind of what Modisset does. He said you'll never find 2 books in his world that have, he'll never do more than 2 books with the same characters. I totally get what you're talking about. You create this world and, maybe the first 5 books are these 3 countries. And then maybe you do a book about this country over here or this country over there. I mean, why not?
Yeah, I mean, my story so far has all been on one continent, and I know there's a whole world there. And I have a pretty good idea of what's on other parts of that world. I don't know if I'm going to get to it in this series, but that doesn't mean that I can't go and work on that some other time.
Sure.
And it's nice to have that kind of endless playground to romp around in. But my next book after this series might be something completely different. I don't really know yet. I'll see when I get there.
Cool. Well, I think that's, we're coming up on about an hour, I guess. And I think that seems like a good place to wrap it up. Peter,
before you do any of that,
Patrick always does. He always extends the podcast by like 20 minutes when I feel like
we started a little late.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to ask a couple questions.
Okay.
Did everybody see that there's going to be a volume 2 for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
No. I did not. No.
Any fans of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen on the
podcast? I read both League of Extraordinary Gentlemen books when they originally came out. I was actually managing a comic book shop when they came out. And I really enjoyed them. I thought the movie wasn't so good.
Oh, the movie was terrible.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a volume 2 set in the 60s, 1960s.
I think that could be awesome.
Yeah.
Alan Moore is going to write it?
Yes.
Okay. I would totally read that. I will. Maybe I'll even be able to read it on my iPad. I've been really getting into reading comics on the iPad.
A lot of people have.
I'm frustrated with the lack of selection, but they're so gorgeous on that color screen, and it's so pleasant to be able to like carry your comic collection around with you in one magazine size thing, and not have to deal with bags and boards. And I love it.
What do you read? I mean, who's your publisher? Do you like DC? Do you like Marvel? Do you like the independents? What are you into?
I was growing up, I was a Marvel guy completely. But I'll read DC things when they're kind of self-contained. I think like Kingdom Come is one of the greatest comics ever written. And, I love Batman, but just, I think in a lot of the DC books, like the continuity reaches a point where it becomes cumbersome. And the both Marvel and DC, once they started doing the like every year there's going to be a big crossover where all the superheroes have to get together to do X, that's when I kind of dropped out of reading the big two.
I'll tell you what. This the Secret Wars was the best of those.
Well, yeah, and when I was a kid and the Secret Wars came out, that was the greatest thing that there ever was.
Yes.
But when you do it every year, like the individual books never get a chance to hit their stride because every, you know, 7 or 8 issues they have to break off to be like, oh, and now we have to go fight the Skrulls, or now we have to go do whatever. And it keeps them from being able to kind of come into their own. Back when it was something that happened once every few years, it was cooler, I think.
I'm trying to remember. There was a writer not too long ago. It was either J. Michael Straczynski or it was Joss Whedon or somebody who had taken over a book or was offered a book, and they're like, you know, we're going into some massive crossover, and the guy just said no.
Yeah,
I don't want to write this book because in six issues, you're going to make me just throw everything that I'm working on out the window to do some massive mega crossover that's just going to piss me off.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the Crisis on Infinite Earths is the thing that ruined those crossovers.
Here's the thing with that. I think I blame Secret Wars 2. So like Crisis on Infinite Earths needed to happen. The DC continuity had reached a point where it was going to collapse in on itself. You had your Earth 1, your Earth 2, and there was the Justice League, and there was the JSA, and there were all these different characters from like different alternate realities, and they were all mixing and matching, and it was so freaking confusing that no new readers were picking up the books because there was just too much to keep up with. And so the purpose of Crisis on Infinite Earths was like, we're going to kill off a crap load of people. We're going to, you know, destroy most of the universe. And there's going to be like one new Earth. And then we're going to start all the books over from day one. And they'll be there'll be Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman and whatever. But like they're all start from scratch, new continuity. You don't have to have read for the last 30 years. And, you know, there's no super dog and there's no super horse and there aren't 18 different kinds of kryptonite. And, you know, there's just one kryptonite and it's only one rock, you know, that, you know, is the size of an orange and that's it. And that made DC Comics come alive again after a long time of kind of stagnation, I think. And I was reading all of those books when they first came out, the John Byrne Superman and the George Perez was doing Wonder Woman and like Frank Miller kind of restarted Batman. It was great. But so the Crisis on Infinite Earths itself wasn't very good, but the goal that it accomplished was commendable, and I think really saved DC Comics in a lot of ways.
I'll give you that. I'll give you that.
Secret Wars 2, however,
was crap.
Yes. And it was just like, how can we get people to read, you know, Cloak and Dagger or like, you know, like whatever bullshit books that nobody wants to read, like Machine Man.
Oh, don't. You know, I still remember, it still pisses me off, The Fall of the Mutants crossing over to Power Pack.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but yeah, that's the kind of shit that they were doing, and it felt like, okay, we're just going to try and force you to read every shit book we make. You know, like whereas with Secret Wars, it was kind of like I was just reading the X-Men when Secret Wars happened. And as I was reading, I was like, maybe I should start reading Spider-Man. He's got that new costume. And so then I started reading Spider-Man. And like it introduced me to all of the Avengers and all of Fantastic Four. And because of that introduction, I started reading a lot of those other books. It's true. I did. But nothing was going to get me to read Machine Man, you know, Cloak and Dagger or whatever. Like there were a lot of bad kind of C-list books that Marvel had that they tried to strong arm you into reading so that you could have the full collection of the Secret Wars too. Right.
Yep.
And it worked, I think. I think that they sold a lot of extra books. And, you know, they wouldn't be doing these big crossovers every year if it didn't make the money and it didn't sell a lot of books.
But there's too many now. There's just too many.
Yeah. And it's distasteful. And I don't care for it anymore. And so I stopped reading it. And so I switched to the Ultimate Universe when they kind of did the Marvel reboot. I was reading all the Ultimate books because there was no crossover and there was no big continuity. And when they did Ultimatum last year, I was like, all right, if they're doing a big crossover, I'm out. Even though I'm reading all the books already, I'm out. Because once they start doing that shit, they'll never stop. And so I stopped reading the Ultimate books that way too.
Yep, because then I think they went into Civil War, didn't they?
No, Civil War was the mainstream Marvel line.
Okay.
And Ultimatum was the Ultimate Universe, which, as far as I know, the twain have not met. Hmm. So I mostly read, like, I read independent books now. And I've been really getting into Mark Waid's Irredeemable and Incorruptible from Boom Comics. Those are fantastic.
I have a... I used to have a habit that the comic book store feeded. And so I had to give that habit up if I wanted to continue paying rent. And I've been clean a little over probably close to 12, 13 years. But I do read the occasional graphic novel. I'll pick up a graphic novel because it'll give me like an entire story arc.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
no, I switched to trades with a lot of books. I buy very few floppies now. It's mostly trades and on everything. It's just so much easier to do. Did John pop off for a while?
Yeah, give me a second here. I'm going to add him back in.
Sorry about that.
I didn't notice when you dropped off.
I know. I let you finish your thoughts.
Yeah, that was I was hoping that you would do that. I don't know why I did that again. All right, well, so do you guys want to – now, Peter, usually what we do is at the end we'll just sort of kind of plug what we kind of have out there now. And we talked a lot about your books. I don't know if there's anything else you want to talk about, if you have anything else coming out, if you're making any other appearances or anything.
We call it pimping your stuff, so pimp your stuff.
Well, the one other thing other than everything we've already mentioned, I am going to be writing Red Sonja for Dynamite Comics later this year. We're still trying to set up where I'm going to be in the lineup, like, you know, which run, but I'm going to do somewhere between 4 and 6 issues. I have a storyline kind of set up. I'm really psyched to do it. I used to read Red Sonja when I was a kid. And so it was one of those things where like you get offered something that is like, oh man, I always wanted to do this. Like I write fantasy, Red Sonja's fantasy. I used to love it when I was a kid. Like, I'm a perv. She's in a chainmail bikini. It works for everybody.
That's
so
great.
I'm really excited to do that.
That's great. I was going to ask you if you'd written any comics or if you were going to be writing comics. That's great to hear that you're going to be doing that. Awesome.
Do you have any author appearances anywhere coming up? You going to go into any more cons or?
I'm going to Worldcon in Australia in September. So I'll be there in Melbourne, and then I'm going to fly to Sydney. I'm going to do a signing in Sydney. I'm going to be doing a signing in L.A. like before I – like I'm doing a stopover in L.A., doing a signing, then going on to Worldcon, then going on to Sydney and doing another signing. And then I'll be at New York Comic Con and World Fantasy this year. And then I'm flying out to Portugal for a fantasy convention out there. In November, and then in January I'm going to Confusion in Detroit, where I'm going to be there with Subterranean Press, because that's when my next Subterranean Press book comes out.
I was going to go to Worldcon in Australia, and then I remembered that I'm poor.
I've never been to a Worldcon. I've always wanted to go to Australia, and Australia was where my book first came out. And so like the first fan mail I got was from Australia, and I have a pretty good reader base there. So I'm really psyched for that trip for a number of reasons. So it's going to be worth the 18 hours in a metal tube to get there.
Yeah. Now, did you say you're going to be at World Fantasy as well?
Yeah, I always go to World Fantasy. I love
World Fantasy. Is that in Ohio?
Yeah, it's in Columbus this year.
Okay, that's cool. And then when is and World Fantasy is in October, I believe.
Yeah, it's always right on Halloween. So it's frustrating that I miss Halloween for it, but that's my favorite convention in a lot of ways because it's all writers, editors, publishers, artists, And so you go into a room and it's like you get to see all your coworkers for a day. It's like everybody is in the business. Everybody will talk shop with you. You go down, you don't even need to go to any of the panels or anything. You just go to the bar and it's like, oh, hey, George R. R. Martin, sure, I'll pass the peanuts. And like, hey, Bill Willingham, you know, great work on Fables. And like, you can't beat it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Hey, well, that's, you know, I went to ReaderCon and a bunch of people were just like, hey, you going to World Fantasy Con? And I'm like, maybe. Like, I didn't even know. I didn't realize that it was such
just remember, thing. John, we have an invitation for dinner with Mike Resnick if we go.
Oh,
you should totally go.
Yeah, I don't know. We got to look into that, Patrick. That's that might be worth it.
I think it definitely would be, yes, because I mean, if we went to that, think about all the names we could drop on the podcast.
I know. Yeah,
just think about all the third nerds you could lasso, yeah. you'd be set for forever.
Yeah, but that's why I go to these conventions, just to get more people to go on the podcast. That's that's my ulterior motive in going to these.
I'll take you around and introduce you to people. It'll be a great time.
Awesome. That'd be awesome. Now, when is New York Comic Con anyway? When is that?
It's in October. I forget let me see if I can pull up the exact date. It's in October this year.
I'm right in New Jersey, so I definitely got to make it out to that one.
It's gotten bigger and bigger every year. It's almost as big as San Diego. And I feel like I've been listening to this. I've been watching the San Diego Twitter feed and so bummed out that I didn't get to go this year. So like New York is going to, I think, be a very gratifying thing for me. It's October 8th through 10th.
Cool.
And you should definitely come out. It's going to be fantastic.
Cool. Awesome.
I'll be doing signings and panels as well there. But I also spend a lot of time just roaming the floor. I love being amongst my people.
You know, awesome. I watched like an hour and a half of the SDCC coverage on G4, and I was exhausted.
It's hardcore going there, but I love it so much. My daughter had to be born on Comic-Con weekend in 2008, and so now, like every year, it's like, oh, do I miss her birthday to go to Comic-Con?
You just gotta wait until she's old enough to go with you.
Well, that's the thing. I can't wait until like a couple more years. I can be like, guess where we're going for your birthday? It's a special present.
Yeah.
And then you just got to hope she doesn't say, no, I want to go to Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah. Well, you know, San Diego has SeaWorld and all that. You can take her to all that stuff too. You know, you can make it a couple days trip, make it a week trip.
It's just cruel to take a toddler into Comic-Con because it's such a madhouse. You know, you have to be old enough to kind of shove people out of your way or else you're just going to get crushed in the press.
Mm-hmm. Now, I see. Now, here's where being single brings you a different point of view, because I can see as a single guy with a toddler that there'd be all kinds of ladies just be willing to talk to me.
Yeah, but it doesn't do you any good when you're married, though, Pat.
I know, that's why I said as a single guy.
Do you mind if they're a stripper in a superheroine costume?
No.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I'm happy to hear that you have so much cool stuff going on there, Peter. That's great for everybody. So for everybody out there that's a fan of Peter, he's going to be all around. So make sure you go and go and see him at one of the various things, and maybe you'll see Patrick and myself at a couple of these upcoming cons as well. Well, Ohio is not a bad choice, as it's kind of halfway between us. You know, it's kind of a reasonable one for us to maybe try to set something up. So we'll have to look into that one for sure.
We'll have to talk about it at our weekly planning.
You should do a live podcast from World Fantasy. You could pull in so many people. It would be awesome.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, we'll have to certainly look into that to see how we can get that going, because that would be amazing. So we'll have to look into that, Patrick, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Here's Lou Anders. And Lou, we've brought Grant Morrison.
Fight it out.
Fight, yeah.
3, 2, 1, fight.
Finish him. Yeah.
All right. Well, Peter, I think
This is the part where we just kind of deteriorate into, you know, crazy stories and laughter.
Yeah, this becomes all the outtake stuff. But anyway, so Peter, thank you so much for being on. I have just, I don't have anything special out this week, but I do have still tons of free music over at scifisongs.blogspot.com. Just go there. There's lots of free MP3s. You can get my album on iTunes or Amazon MP3 or lots of other places. Just put my name or Sci-Fi Songs in the search engine. I'm on Twitter/John Aneelio, JohnAneelio. Oh, and we should mention that Peter is on Twitter as well. I think it's PV Brett is your Twitter handle.
PVBRETT. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And apparently his pants are falling down in public.
Yeah, learn all about that on my Twitter feed. Or you can go to petervbrett.com as well.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very cool website, by the way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Definitely. Like definitely.
I spent a lot of work on that.
John, are you recording your show this week?
My gig tomorrow. I might throw up my little H2 tomorrow. I'm playing a gig tomorrow, so maybe I'll record it, and if it comes out okay, maybe I'll throw a couple of those tracks up on the site
kind of thing. Might as well.
And I know I have to record something. Do we want to mention our other project that we have going, Patrick, or do we want to keep that a secret still? Well, I guess it's still out there, so I guess we can...
The cat bag all out. Yeah.
Do you want to pimp your stuff first, or do you want to talk about our project now?
Yes. First off, I want to... Do you remember Aidan Moore?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have anything to say about it. He just really likes it when we mention him on the podcast.
I know.
I have all the usual stuff. My blog is all things from my brain, atfmb.com. Twitter feed, twitter.com/atfmb, all things from my brain. The serialized science fiction comes out every Friday, and that's at atfmb.com/EVERMIST, Evermist. We have functionalnerds.com, and we have the daily nerd news roundups being brought to us by Scott Seeley, who is the Herald of Galactus. I just try to come up with something new to say every day because he's so cool and he's doing this for me. And so, you know, I got to come up with something cool to say about him every day. So today he's the Herald of Galactus. And then we have the huge, big, extra special new podcast that we're going to be doing along with our friends over at sfsignal.com. And that's the sfsignal.com podcast.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. That's so great that you guys are doing that.
It is. We're excited. I mean, honestly, we actually started this podcast with the, ulterior motive of being the SF Signal podcast. But we are going to – Functional Nerds is going to remain the way it is. We're still going to keep it kind of as this – the way it's been going as kind of a real open-ended about an hour show about whatever you may.
And this is our thing too. I mean, and we can do whatever the hell we want with it. If we're doing SF Signals, we kind of gotta, do their thing.
Yeah. So the SF Signal, I mean, we've really enjoyed what we've been doing with Functional Nerds. So it's going to keep going the way that it's been going. So if you're a fan of Functional Nerds, do not fret. We're going to keep doing this here. But we, in conjunction with SF Signal, it's going to be a little different, a little more streamlined. We're going to have two segments. We're going to have like a 15-minute roundtable with Patrick and myself and some of the SF Signal irregulars. And we'll talk about, whatever sort of big topics there were that week in the science fiction and fantasy world. And then we are going to try to do a 15-minute or so interview with an author or other science fiction luminary. And so the whole show will probably be about a half hour, kind of broken up into two segments of the 15-minute interview and the 15-minute roundtable. And we're really excited, and we're going to start recording that this week. And I guess the first episode will be out on Monday. Is that the plan?
Don't know yet. We don't.
Okay.
I've kind of been talking to JP and John D a little bit about that, just because I don't know if they haven't figured out yet how to set it up on sfsignal.com.
Okay.
But the post actually did call for it to go on that first Monday, but they kind of took that out of the post. So I'm not sure if it's going to be that Monday or the next Monday.
Well, either way, it'll be soon, and we're excited about it, and we're excited to still keep going with the Functional Nerds and sort of excited to be sort of folded into the SF Signal world as well. And Peter, we would love to have you on Nerds, and we'd like to maybe even have you as one of those 15-minute author interviews for the SF Signal podcast as well. And
I don't know that I count as a luminary, but I'll be happy to be on.
Well, that would be great. That'd be great. So anyway, I think that's about it for this week. So everybody, thank you for joining us. And next week we have Jessica Barton, so who a lot of you may not know her by name, but I think you might at some point. She is actually the book Nerdist. I mentioned Chris Hardwick's podcast, The Nerdist, earlier in the show, and he put a call out to have different people write for his blog, The Nerdist blog. And Jessica Barton is writing book reviews and doing some science fiction and fantasy book reviews as well. And she's a great reviewer, great writer, a great sense of humor. And I was kind of chatting her up on Twitter a little bit, and I said, like, why don't you be on our podcast? So she's going to be on our podcast as well. And I think for Nerds, I think she's going to be she's going to get pretty well known, I think, just kind of being associated with Hardwick's blog and podcast. So I'm real excited that we're going to have her on next week. So
very cool.
That's who our guest next week is.
Cool.
So join us then, and thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, Patrick always does a little outtakes at the end of an episode, so he'll probably end up working it in the outtake.
Hello.
Hello.
Patrick, are you getting any of this, or?
I'm sorry, I was distracted by something else. I'm easily distracted. I apologize. I'm just trying to find my pen. Someone has stolen my pen. And John just went offline.
Freaking Skype, man. It's like, how dare this amazing new technology not be perfect yet?
John is still on a Wi-Fi connection. He's out in his garage. So
literally?
Literally, he's in his garage, yeah. That's the quiet spot in his house right now.
Like, I have some questions.
Do you have Merle Lafferty's no cursing rule?
No, you can curse. That's fine.
Hey, hey! Watch your goddamn language.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm from Brooklyn, and I'm just afraid that, like, the Brooklyn's going to come out, you know?
No, let it come out. It's totally fine.
Well, yeah, it's like the Rolling Stone guys told McChrystal. They're like, oh, don't worry. It's fine. We won't print that.
When has the press ever screwed the military? Come on, dude.
Never.
Have another beer.
It would never happen. How could you imagine that would happen?
Now, John, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Have you ever actually written a song about The Hobbit?
No. No, I haven't, actually.
Your website is a lie. Next week, I expect a song about smog.
Okay. See what I can do.
That would be kind of awesome, actually.
Yeah.
Or you could just take one of Tolkien's songs and actually put it to music.
Ooh,
they did that in the Rankin Bass, like, animated.
Frodo of the Nine Fingers.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.